This call is being recorded.
Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Hollander. I'm a research analyst focused on outreach at GiveWell. And it is 9 a.m. Pacific, so planning to get the call started now. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. We offer this conference call annually as a chance to learn about our updated top charities and to ask any questions that you have about our research. Before we get started on the details of our latest recommendations and the questions that you submitted, I just wanted to quickly introduce the two people that I'm joined with from GiveWell, which is Josh Rosenberg and Natalie Crispin. Josh and Natalie are senior research analysts at GiveWell and have contributed significantly to the research and recommendations that we published this year. So just to briefly touch on the logistics of the call, this call will be 1 hour long. I am going to make brief remarks at the beginning about our latest research, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. We received a large number of pre-submitted questions, so we will also aim to answer those here or to follow up via email if we run out of time to cover all of them. So thank you very much for sending in your questions in advance. This was covered in the email that I sent out with the call logistics, but just wanted to briefly remind you how to ask a question on this call. As you saw when you joined, we have muted all participants in order to maintain reasonable audio quality. And there will be two main ways to ask questions on the call. First, if you've called in using the Uber Conference URL, you can use the chat interface on the right side of the screen to announce that you have a question. Or you can email info@givewell.org and let us know that you have a question. In both cases, please share your phone number so we know whose line to unmute, unless you've only joined using your computer, in which case, no need to share your phone number. We can see your name. There's also no need to write out the full question in advance, but if you're able to share the general topic, that will help us group answers to questions on the same topic together. Finally, if you prefer to email your question in and have me read it, you can email info@givewell.org, and I will go ahead and read the question for you on the call. And we've gotten a few submissions that way, so I'll plan to cover those as well. Finally, we generally default to publishing information publicly at GiveWell, while being willing to keep information confidential when specific parties request it. So consistent with this, we're planning to record this call and to post the recording and potentially a transcript on our website. If you make any comments that you'd like us to remove, please just let us know after the call by emailing info@givewell.org, and we're happy to do so. So with those logistics out of the way, I'm just going to provide a very brief, about 5-minute overview of our updated top charities list before we open it up for questions. So GiveWell looks for top charities each year that meet our four criteria. They're evidence-backed, cost-effective, transparent, and in need of additional funding. And we publish a short list of charity recommendations for anyone to use based on the research that we do. We published this year's update on November 26th. We currently recommend 8 top charities that meet our criteria. 3 of these groups work on programs to avert deaths, and 5 of them work on programs to increase incomes or consumption. Our list of top charities is the same as it was last year, with one exception. We removed Evidence Action's No Lien Season from our list of recommended charities. We had added No Lien Season to our top charities list at the end of 2017 for the first time. We removed them from the list this year following a review of the results of a 2017 study of the program, which is intended to induce migration among low-income agricultural workers in rural northern Bangladesh during the time of year when job opportunities are scarce. That's the major change to our list this year. Our bottom line recommendation for donors this year who are interested in following our recommendations is to first choose the option to support grants to recommended charities at GiveWell's discretion on our donate forms. This option is one in which we grant the funds quarterly to the GiveWell top charity or top charities where we believe they can do the most good. We take into account charities' funding needs as well as donations they've received from other sources when we decide where to grant these discretionary funds. and we then make these grants to the highest value funding opportunities we see among the charities that we've recommended on our list. However, if you prefer to give to a specific charity, we believe that all of our top charities are outstanding and will use additional funding effectively. If we at GiveWell had additional funds to allocate, the most likely recipient would be Malaria Consortium to scale up its work providing seasonal malaria chemo prevention. As part of our work to publish our updated top charities list, we also made a recommendation to Good Ventures, a large foundation that works with GiveWell closely. Good Ventures has been a major supporter of GiveWell's top charities since 2011. Every year, we provide recommendations to Good Ventures regarding how we believe it can most effectively allocate its grants to GiveWell's recommended charities. And this year, we recommended that Good Ventures grant $64 million to our recommended charities, though we note here that Good Ventures has not finalized its plans for the year and may give differently from what we've recommended. We take this funding that we've recommended to Good Ventures into account when we are deciding what to recommend to other donors who use our research. Finally, as donors using our research, we think that the following comparisons among our top charities are important to be aware of. There are several major factors that we consider when we're comparing the top charities on our list. One is their estimated cost effectiveness relative to cash transfers at the present margin. So how cost effective do we think that donating to those charities now is? The second factor is what the primary benefits of the intervention that they're implementing are. So I mentioned earlier that we recommend three charities that we believe the primary benefit of is averting deaths, and five that we think the benefit of is increasing incomes or consumption. As donors, the way that you think about the value of those two different outcomes might vary and can be an important consideration to have in mind when choosing where to donate. We also look at the quality of the organization's communication with GiveWell. This is a subjective measure based on dozens or hundreds of hours of interaction that we have with each charity on our list. We see this as a proxy for the organization's competence and thoughtfulness. We also look at the charity's ongoing monitoring and the likelihood of detecting future problems. This impacts our cost-effectiveness analysis of the charity and also is a proxy for the organization's competence and openness. Finally, we think that donors should consider their risk tolerance or their interest in certainty relative to risk when considering which of our top charities to support. Four of our top charities implement deworming programs, and we recommend the provision of deworming treatments to children because of its possible impact on recipients' incomes in adulthood. We work in an expected value framework, so in other words, we are willing to support a higher risk intervention if it has the potential for higher impact. Deworming is such an intervention. We think that it might have very little impact, but that risk is outweighed by the possibility that it has a very large impact, and it's very cheap to implement. So donors who have a lower risk tolerance may choose not to support charities implementing deworming programs. We think these are important considerations to have in mind when choosing which top charity to support if you're interested in picking a specific charity, and we're really happy to answer any questions that you have about the specific ways in which we make this comparison between our top charities. I'm going to pause the update here. As I mentioned, we're glad to get into any more detail on any of the above during the Q&A. As a quick reminder of the logistics of asking a question on this call, please either use the chat interface on the right side of the screen if you're called in using the Uber conference URL, or email info@givewell.org. And in both cases, please share your phone number as well as the general topic that you're planning to ask about so we can group it together. I'm going to start with some of the pre-submitted questions that we received as folks send in their questions in real time. And these are questions that came in via the RSVP form. And one of the first questions that we got came in from Sophie. And the question was that she would like to hear from the researchers on the methods a little bit. And so I'd like to turn this over to my colleague Natalie to talk a little bit about the ways in which we assess the top charities on our list and how we come to the recommendations that we have. So Natalie, could you please answer this question?
So just to cover at a high level our evaluation process, and please do ask any follow-up questions about anything that you'd like to hear more about. We generally start at the program level or intervention level, and so we do evidence reviews of possible ways that an organization might, possible programs that an organization might run, and model the cost effectiveness of those programs to see whether they are competitive with the programs we already recommend. The programs then go on a list of priority programs that we keep on our website, and then we seek out organizations or make connections with organizations that run similar programs to those, and ask more detailed questions about how they operate those programs and whether they need additional funding, and generally whether they meet our criteria for being a top charity. And so much of the work that we do with organizations that could become top charities in the future is conversations with them, both over the phone and in person, and requesting information that they collect on their activities, such as how they're spending funding, what information they're collecting on how effective the programs are at achieving the outcomes expected, and how cost-effective those programs are, and then finally, importantly, how they would spend additional funding, and whether there are bottlenecks to their scaling up other than funding. And so we have those conversations generally over several months. We write a in-depth review of what we've learned, have discussions with the organization about whether we've missed anything in that review, whether we could improve that review, and then publish that on our website as part of either that organization being added as a top charity or generally sharing our findings. And so that's the very broad picture. So yeah, please do ask any questions if you want more detail on how we go about those parts of the process.
Great, thanks, Natalie. And I wanted to follow up with a question for Josh that was submitted by Drake. And this question was, how to inform charity selection as a function of moral values for life intrinsically versus hedonic well-being? So Josh, could you talk a little bit about the way that GiveWell thinks about moral weights and some of the work that we've done to think about how we're doing this, using those inputs?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm not sure if I'm going to be touching on exactly what Drake had in mind, so please do follow up if I'm not interpreting the terms you used correctly. But what I took you to be asking about was how we compare charities that avert deaths. As Catherine mentioned, three of our top charities primarily focus on averting deaths versus charities that improve well-being through outcomes such as increasing income. And so, you know, when we're comparing the overall cost effectiveness of charities, of course, charities focus on different outcomes. And so we have to make some kind of comparison at the end. If you say that, you know, one charity averts a death for, you know, our rough best guess is around $2,000, and another can double a family's income for a rough best guess is around $100, you need to think about how those ultimately compare in where you'd want to give. And we've gone through a number of different ways of thinking about the problem of how to compare the value of those outcomes. First, you know, we thought about what other actors have done to think about this question. So there are commonly used frameworks such as the Disability Adjusted Life Year framework. I won't go into explaining that, but you can find a lot more information about that on our website. So we've tried to think about, you know, when governments and other actors who are allocating substantial amounts of funds are thinking about, you know, how to allocate across programs with these different kinds of outcomes, how do they make those decisions, and we've used that as a rough benchmark. But what we ultimately do is we publish the comparisons that we are making in our cost effectiveness analysis. You can see it on a tab called our moral weights tab. You know, that's kind of the ultimate comparison that we're making, and you can see how we're thinking about that. And if you have different views from us, then you can input your own values and see what that implies about which of our top charities would be the best ones to give to from your perspective. So we've written a lot more about, you know, how the way that we do this compares to other actors in a blog post. And so you can find that by Googling GiveWell Moral Weights. That's some of the work we've done on this question.
Great. Thank you, Josh. I'd like to move into some questions that we got on GiveWell's top charities this year. And we'd like to start with a question for Natalie that was submitted by Eric. The question is, it looks like the big change since last year is elevating the Malaria Consortium over the Against Malaria Foundation for incremental donations, and it seems like the Against Malaria Foundation got a much lower allocation from Good Ventures. It would be good to hear more color on this. Natalie, would you be up for sharing some more color on how we're thinking about Malaria Consortium compared to AMF?
Yeah, definitely. So the big change this year between those two organizations is that last year we recommended that individuals who were interested in supporting our top charities and wanted to give directly to organizations rather than to GiveWell for regranting at our discretion, give 70% of their donation to AMF, the Against Malaria Foundation, and 30% to the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative. This year, we haven't made a similar recommendation. We have said that as before, one great option is to give to GiveWell for regranting at our discretion, because we'll be following up with the organizations over the next few months, understanding what their remaining funding needs are, and making a determination as to where to give those funds to in the first couple months of the year. For individuals who are interested in giving directly, our best guess is that those incremental funds will go to Malaria Consortium for supporting their seasonal malaria chemo prevention program. And the reason for expecting that additional funding will most likely to go to Malaria Consortium rather than AMF as it did last year is is largely based on a head-to-head comparison of those two organizations. They both work on malaria programs that prevent deaths among young children. They're different programs, but we think we can make a pretty reasonable cost-effectiveness comparison between those two. And due to updates to that cost-effectiveness model, our best guess is now that Malaria Consortium's program is more cost-effective than AMF's. And there's a lot of uncertainty in that model. This is a change from last year based on additional factors that we've added into the model, and certainly could change in the future. But we try to take those estimates seriously and make our best guesses based on them. There's also other factors that we looked at in comparing those two organizations. So the proxies that we use for thinking about organizational competence and thoughtfulness and quality of ongoing monitoring, we think that we have more confidence in Malaria Consortium. We think they're both excellent organizations, but based on our own subjective experiences with them, we have somewhat more confidence in Malaria Consortium's programs as a result of those interactions, and as well as the quality of the monitoring. So we'll be continuing to look at those two organizations' funding needs over the next few months. I think there's been some uncertainty as to AMF's funding needs because of a large amount of funding they have on hand, but also a large opportunities to spend that funding. And so we may see over the next few months that picture becomes more clear and that AMF has high quality funding needs. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. We have a better picture of Malaria Consortium's funding needs and think that marginal or incremental donations would do a lot of good there. And so we already have that confidence. So we'll be making that decision in the next few months, but right now the factors have lined up more in favor of supporting Malaria Consortium at the current margin.
Great, thank you, Natalie. The next question is from Charles, and it's to provide more detail on the removal of No Lien Season from our top charities list. And I'm planning to answer this one. So some additional context on No Lien Season. GiveWell began engaging with No Lean Season, which is an organization, as I mentioned earlier, that focuses on providing subsidies to enable seasonal migration in rural northern Bangladesh during the time of year when job opportunities tend to be most scarce. And we became interested in No Lean Season through our incubation grants program back in 2013. GiveWell Incubation Grants is a part of our work where we're trying to support the development of potential future top charities, as well as to better understand our current top charities. And at the time that we initially connected with them, we saw No Lean Season as a promising program that didn't yet have the kind of track record to be considered for a top charity recommendation at that time, back in 2013. We made several incubation grants to support their scale-up and further study of the program, and by the end of 2017, felt that we had enough information to recommend No Lean Season as a top charity at that time. And we based our decision to recommend No Lean Season as a top charity on three randomized control trials, which is a type of study that GiveWell considers to be very useful in determining the effectiveness of programs. The first two RCTs that we looked at were conducted in 2008 and 2014, and they indicated that the program increased migration, income, and consumptions for the participants. There was also a third unpublished RCT that was conducted in 2013, where the program was considered to have failed to induce migration, and that was potentially due to political violence that year. But weighing the evidence, those three RCTs, the cost of the program, and the potential impacts, we decided that No Lean Season met our criteria to be named a top charity in November of 2017. At the time that we made this recommendation, we noted that No Lean Season was also conducting another RCT of their program during the 2017 lean season, and the lean season is from roughly September to December of the year, and we make our recommendations in late November. So we were aware that there was an ongoing RCT of their program during that lean season. This summer, No Lean Season began to discuss with us the preliminary results from that 2017 lean season RCT. And those results suggested that the program, as it was implemented in 2017, did not successfully induce migration. The implementation of the No Lean Season program in 2017 differed from previous years in important ways. The program took place at a much larger scale. Around 150,000 households were reached compared to around 16,000 in 2016, and there was also a higher intensity delivery of the intervention as well as broader eligibility requirements. And at this point, neither GiveWell, No Lean Season, nor the researchers feel that we have a conclusive understanding of why the program failed to induce migration in the 2017 lean season. And so we incorporated these results into our understanding of the program. We updated our estimate of the cost effectiveness of No Lean Season, and also just looked at the sort of qualitative evidence picture. And we decided that in 2018, No Lean Season does not meet our top charity requirements. No Lean Season is not seeking additional funding at this time, but they have 2 years of additional funding remaining, and they're planning to run another RCT at scale during the 2018 implementation round, which is happening now. And they're also trying to perform other analyses to help us better understand why the 2017 program might have failed to induce migration. And they expect to have preliminary results to share with us in mid-2019. The sort of bottom line for us is that, you know, the decision to remove a top charity is not an easy one, but we also take very seriously the part of our work that is to continuously evaluate the groups on our list and to, you know, maintain our commitment to evidence, even when the results are not positive. And we're extremely excited to work with a group like Evidence Action that's so committed to rigorous program evaluation and open discussion of the results of those evaluations. And going through this process with Evidence Action definitely increased our confidence in their work as an organization. And so we're waiting to see the results from the 2018 RCT in mid-2019. And that's sort of the next step on our agenda. I would next like to turn the questioning over to Jennifer Gerton, who I'm going to unmute so that you can ask the question that you submitted via info@givewell.org related to cost-effective global health interventions. So Jennifer, you should be unmuted now.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jennifer Gertan. I'm with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health here in Baltimore, Maryland. I understand GiveWell recommends giving funds for development efforts overseas and prioritizes global health. My question is, does GiveWell have its own list of cost-effective global health interventions? We work in family planning, and there's significant evidence around the return on investment for family planning as an intervention. And I'm interested in knowing if you've considered funding family planning organizations and or programs, as they're not included in your current top list of charities and their work. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, so just first on the list of cost-effective global health programs that we prioritize. On our website, we have a list of all of the intervention reports, as we call them, that we completed, which are basically just reviews of the evidence base for different programs. And on that page, we have a table with what we call priority programs. And those are the programs that we think stand out in terms of evidence and cost effectiveness. And so you can go on our website and see our full list of reports there. On family planning in particular, so we have not yet done a deep investigation of that area. We've done some early work and have identified some high quality studies, but have struggled to determine whether those are relevant to particular charities programs. Going back to the process that Natalie described earlier, basically we first try to review the independent evidence base for a program. So that's identifying high quality studies, figuring out if there are programs that could be cost effective that could be potentially scaled up by particular charities. And so that's the stage of the process where we are with family planning right now. And it's basically just trying to find those high quality studies and seeing if there are charities that work on them, so we could think about what the kind of cost per outcome would be in that area. So still early work there, hope to be able to say more in the future.
Thanks, Josh. I'm going to next unmute the line of Soha from Save the Children. I believe I've got the right line here, but let me know if not. And there were questions submitted related to measuring impact and cost effectiveness for more behavioral change or advocacy related interventions, and also some questions about our timeline for becoming a top charity. I'm going to unmute you now.
Hi, this is Soha from Save the Children in Connecticut. And I guess my first question is around the areas of focus, and I see most of it is around health and the way we measure impact and cost effectiveness of health, I guess works in a certain way that may not work for more holistic approaches, and that may include components of advocacy or behavioral change. And I was wondering, how you would address this kind of difference in programmatic outcomes when looking at impact and cost effectiveness.
Thank you. Josh or Natalie, would one of you like to take?
Sure. There are a few behavioral change type of programs that we've looked at in the past. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how you would define that category, but I think arguably No Lean Seasons work, which is providing conditional loans for people to migrate to cities, is a type of behavioral change program, and Development Media International, which is on our standout charities list, does health messaging to try to change health behaviors. So those are a couple of examples of charities that we've evaluated. Largely, that process was made easier by the fact that randomized controlled trials were run on those programs, and so fit fairly cleanly into our process. That said, I recognize that a lot of programs, particularly in the behavioral change and advocacy spaces, are more challenging to evaluate just with randomized controlled trials, and also present more questions around if you do a study, for which populations is that study applicable, and will that program continue to work in the same way in the future? I would say that these are two areas that we are interested in doing more research on in the future. One major goal of GiveWells going forward is that we don't want to be, you know, as constrained as we have been in the past by what is easily measurable. And so we're basically planning to build incrementally outward into the areas that we think are most promising, that are less straightforward than some of our previous evaluations. So, you know, policy advocacy work is particularly high on our list. We published a blog post about that earlier this year, and maybe we'll get more into that on the call. But we do believe that, you know, there are potentially highly cost-effective areas that we just haven't had the capacity or it hasn't been as tractable for us to evaluate in the past. And so we are hoping to do more in those areas in the future.
Great. Thanks, Josh. I'm next going to unmute the line of Claire, who wrote into info with a question about our selection process for our top charities next year and leverage and funding. Claire, your line should be unmuted now. All right, it seems like we might not have Claire at the moment, but I'll ask these questions on her behalf. So Claire asks, do you envision maintaining the same selection process for top charities for the next year, 2019? Natalie, could you please answer that question?
Sure. So it's a little bit to be determined in that our planning process for next year will happen over the next couple months. But in general, as Josh was discussing, we do hope to continue to sort of push the boundaries of what we've been doing and be able to evaluate different types of organizations and types of programs. We will continue to look for organizations that meet our, that could become top charities according to our the process that we've used in the past. So looking at programs that have been rigorously shown to have a cost-effective impact through randomized controlled trials or other high-quality research methods, and then reach out to organizations or identify organizations that could that are running those programs or might be interested in running those programs. And so that, you know, will definitely be a continued part of our process, and then it is more up in the air what other types of interventions we'll be able to evaluate in the next year. And so we'll be working out that process and where our priorities which organizations, which programs we should focus on in the next year, in the next couple months, and be publishing that plan on our blog.
Great. Thanks, Natalie. And the second part of the question was, could you detail a little more your approach to leverage and funding in your cost effectiveness model? Josh?
Sure. Yeah, so the question of leverage and funding is a very challenging one. So basically what we're trying to answer there is, suppose that we give you know, X million dollars to a charity, how does that affect what other funders would do? So leverage would be, if we give X million dollars to a charity, then the other funder gives more, perhaps because they want, you know, matching funds or they want to see that another donor is involved. And so we have the more impact than just the dollars that we gave, because we actually cause more dollars to go to a charity. And what we call funging is when we cause someone else to give less. So, you know, this comes up most when we're thinking about the impact that we might have on government funding for programs. You know, if we give more to a BedNets program, for example, does that mean that the local government spends less on that type of work? So we've written a blog post on this, and we've also, made some detailed judgments on this in our cost effectiveness analysis. The basic approach that we take is that for each program, we try to think about, what are the impacts that our funding is having on other organizations, and then we do have to also make best guesses about what that actually means in terms of humanitarian impact, because if we cause another donor to give less, that means that they can do something else with their funds, and that use of funds may still be reasonably cost effective. And so So we basically have a very complex framework that's a bit difficult to explain verbally. But I think if you look at our blog post on this and our cost effectiveness analysis, you'll see a little more beyond the basics I just provided.
Great. Thanks, Josh. I'd like to shift into a few questions about our ongoing research. And I know we've touched on this one, but I think we could probably provide a little bit more color, which is a question from Pascal about policy advocacy. And I believe that I saw your name on the line. So here, I will unmute you. Pascal, you had a question that you submitted about policy advocacy. And you should be unmuted. All right, if we don't seem to connect right now, I will ask this question on your behalf, which is, do you have an update on policy advocacy organizations that you can share? And this links to the post that we wrote about the Center for Pesticide Suicide Prevention as a specific policy advocacy organization that we're working in.
Sure. So, you know, I'd say the basic update is that we did not make as much progress in this area as we had hoped to this year. But we have done some initial work in this area. So, you know, you had linked the Center for Pesticide Suicide Prevention blog post. So we did make an incubation grant to that organization. And then we've done some initial investigation in some other policy cause areas. So, you know, as I mentioned before, we're trying to think about building incrementally outward in terms of complexity from where we currently are. And so we began by thinking about particular what you might call, you know, vertical health policy areas. So things like tobacco taxation or reducing lead in the environment in developing countries. And so you can see conversation notes from conversations we've had about both of those topics on our website. We've also, you know, had some conversations with organizations that provide technical assistance basically to you know, help governments achieve good policy outcomes. And so you can see some conversation notes that we've had from conversations with the J-PAL Government Partnership Initiative. And those are examples of some of the early stage work that we've done. But I'd say that, you know, overall, this is still a high priority for us. We hope to do more of it in the next year and to have, you know, more comprehensive update then. And I do expect that we'll, you know, have more to say about the areas that I mentioned and more to say about some of these other health policy cause areas soon, and hopefully building out to other policy cause areas from there.
Great, thanks, Josh. We've also had a couple questions submitted related to nutrition and infant and young child feeding interventions. So I'm going to read those out. They're from Rolf and Anam, and I'm going to combine them. Rolf asks, will infant and young child feeding interventions and community-based management of acute malnutrition be priorities for GiveWell in 2019? If so, would they consider supporting organizations that implement these interventions? And from Anam, what is GiveWell's current thinking on nutrition interventions? Are there any cost-effective nutrition interventions that GiveWell has come across and are currently exploring?
Sure. So, yeah, I'll take each of these in turn. So on nutrition interventions overall, we do have some standout charities and have made some incubation grants to charities that are working on various micronutrients. So programs like doing salt iodization to improve cognitive development or doing iron fortification to reduce anemia and improve cognition. So we do have examples of some charities that we have evaluated in the nutrition space. We've also done some early stage evaluation of other programs, one example of which is community management of acute malnutrition, which Rolf was asking about. So we've published a report on that program in particular. I think that, you know, we call out basically some of the major questions that we would need to answer to better assess whether a charity working on that program could be a top charity. So, you know, there were some substantial questions in the evidence base about, you know, what is the impact on mortality from that program? and a couple of other key questions that you can see in our public report on that. But basically, I'd say it's still to be determined exactly which, if any, of these programs will prioritize in 2019. They are, you know, definitely programs that are on our mind and we're considering. So you know, both community management of acute malnutrition and some other programs as well, possibly some programs in the iron fortification space and other programs in the nutrition area. So we are, you know, doing evaluation in that space and trying to improve our views there.
Great. Thanks, Josh. The next question was, we had similar questions submitted from Megan and Abby, and I'm going to group those together. And this is a question for Josh and Natalie. The question is, which new interventions will we be looking into in 2019?
Great. Yeah, I'm happy to start, and then Natalie can add anything. So, as Natalie was mentioning, we're in the middle of planning right now, so still figuring out exactly what we're going to be doing. You know, I'll list some options that are on our list. I'm not sure that we'll move forward with these, but just to give some sense of what we're thinking about. So, you know, there are a few in the nutrition space that I was just mentioning. So, you know, biofortification of foods, community management of acute malnutrition, and iron fortification are all programs that we've done recent evaluations of and are potentially interested in, though unsure whether we'll ultimately move forward. We've published a number of other, you know, what we call intervention reports on programs that seem potentially promising. One in the incubation grants area that seems possible is screening and treatment for syphilis. And then, you know, some other programs that we've been looking at include fistula surgery, providing eyeglasses to workers to basically improve productivity, and voluntary medical male circumcision to reduce HIV. So, you know, programs across the board are ones that we're considering. And then, you know, I also previously mentioned that policy is an area that we hope to make more progress on and talked a little bit about some of our priorities there. So, you know, those are examples of the types of programs that we're thinking about, and we'll have more to say hopefully early next year about which of them we're actually going to go substantially deeper on.
Great. Thanks, Josh. The next question, I would like to group a few together. Related to long-term impact. We have a question from AJ on whether GiveWell would look into organizations that focus on the long-term. And then we have questions from Tom, Ellen, and Natalie related to GiveWell and climate change and whether we would ever recommend a climate change organization.
Sure, I can take this. So our evaluation process is definitely open to looking at organizations that can have a long-term impact, and the best example of this is deworming that has had the major research on deworming was done in the late 1990s, and there's been several rounds of follow-up. So there's now, I believe, been 15 years of follow-up. And they're continuing to follow the populations that receive the program and compare them to the control group over time, and find that the program has, in fact, according to the study, had a long-term impact on the incomes of children who benefited from the deworming in childhood. That type of research does tend to be fairly rare. So these very long-term follow-ups of randomized controlled trials are few and far between. And that does limit our ability to rely on that kind of work and track long-term impact. And so as a result, our top charity list does tend to focus more on impacts that can be measured fairly quickly. Although, you know, those interventions may in fact have a long-term impact, such as, you know, several of our top charities save or avert deaths among young children, and that certainly has a long-term impact on their lives and the lives of those around them. in terms of climate change, I think that is an area that is incredibly important and would be really, we would be certainly very open to finding interventions that could make demonstrable progress on reducing the impact of climate change. We haven't yet found any interventions like that, and generally my impression is that a lot of the work on climate change to date has been policy advocacy type of work, and that's an area, as Josh highlighted, is something we want to do more on in the future, and could potentially look at climate change, although we're starting with areas that seem to us more tractable. And so it's not a high priority in the short term, but is certainly not in any way off the table for our process in the longer term. And so, in general, we want to be making more progress on policy impact, and that is another area that could have long-term impact, though we think many of our top charities are also impacting lives both in the short term and the long term.
Great. Thanks, Natalie. And I'd like to circle up on deworming, which you just mentioned. We received a question from Brad via info@givewell.org that says, the Gates Foundation seems to have stopped funding some of the deworming charities that you recommend. Do you know why, and how has that impacted your recommendation?
Right, so the Gates Foundation I'm not the best to speak on this. They, I don't fully understand their strategy, but my impression is that they are more focused on proof of concept and research than on continued implementation of programs, and so they played a significant role in starting the schistosomiasis control initiative and in some of the ongoing research that touches on deworming. However, their primary focus has not been on ongoing funding for reaching additional children with deworming medication, and that may be an outdated view. I'm not sure if they are considering that for the future, but that I think has their. The way in which they funded groups, I think, has been consistent with that to date, and I don't think reflects a changing view of those particular organizations and their impact or ongoing cost effectiveness.
Great. Thanks, Natalie. This is just a quick reminder to please submit any additional questions that you have. Now is a good time to do that as we're coming into the last 10 minutes of the call. So please feel free to add them to the chat on the right-hand side of the Uber Conference URL if you're logged in via your computer, or to email info@givewell.org, and we're happy to read that out for you or to unmute your line. The next question that I have also came in via info@givewell.org, and it's a question related to an upcoming GiveDirectly study. This question is from Brad, and the question is, with respect to the GiveDirectly upcoming study, which seems to be what you're waiting for to decide how to react to the IMF blog discussion of that charity's work, when do you expect that study to come out? Josh, could you give a little background on this question and what it's referring to, and also an update on what we've seen with regard to the study?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we wrote a May 2018 blog post discussing the spillover effects of cash transfers, which are the effects that cash transfers may have on neighbors of people who receive cash transfers. And so there was a lot of interest in this question in sort of the blog discussion in the development economics community, a lot of it happening on the World Bank Development Impact blog. And so, in particular, there were some results that suggested that there may be negative effects on neighbors, you know, that perhaps providing cash transfers to some in a community could decrease consumption or decrease psychological well-being for others in the community. And we wrote then that, one major update to our view that we were expecting was going to be from a study of GiveDirectly's program called the General Equilibrium Study. And so basically, this is just, the largest study yet on this question of the effects that cash transfers have on the broader community, even for people who aren't receiving transfers, and was, had a methodology that was specifically designed to try to answer that question both within villages and across villages. And the latter is, something that we hadn't seen much before and is especially relevant to GiveDirectly's current program where they treat almost all households in Kenya and Uganda. They still do treat just eligible households in Rwanda. But the basic update here is that we have seen early draft private results from that study, and we've published an update to our view. So you can see that it's linked from our updated Top Charities announcement from this year. And the bottom line is that right now, our best guess is that the positive or negative effects of cash transfers on neighbors are minimal on net. I do think that this is an area of research that is still relatively early and where we could learn a lot more and potentially update in the future. But the bottom line is that, this large new study found, either no spillover effects on net or slight positive effects. And we put some weight on the previous studies that found negative effects. And you can see our page to see more about how we think about trying to combine and think about all the issues there and how we came out to our bottom line. But the bottom line update is we have seen that study. And so you can read a bit more on our site.
Thanks, Josh. I have a follow-up question that was pre-submitted by Lucas, also about wealth transfer organizations. And the question is, how many kinds of less effective aid programs should be replaced by wealth transfer organizations like GiveDirectly? And what kinds of programs need to exist alongside cash transfer programs, i.e., what problems can't wealth transfer programs solve? And there's a related question I'll actually ask along with this, I think, from Natalie, and the question is, has any progress been made globally to benchmark high-impact sectors to ensure investors can have the most impact for their buck?
Great. Yeah, so, on the first question about wealth transfers and how many kinds of less effective aid programs should be replaced, so I think we don't have a great answer to this question. I think that, we are very focused on finding the most cost-effective charities that fit our criteria. And so if a program looks like it's likely to be less cost-effective than GiveDirectly, that gets deprioritized fairly quickly in our process, and we don't go deeper on finding out exactly whether it is less cost-effective than GiveDirectly, basically just because we're trying to maximize the impact of the dollars that we're directing. And so it's less relevant for us to be thinking about that sort of lower end of the range of cost effectiveness of programs. That said, GiveDirectly does have an initiative where it's trying to do what it calls cash benchmarking. So working with actors like USAID and others to look at the effectiveness of cash relative to programs that they are running. And there is, I think the first study from this initiative was released earlier this year. The authors are McIntosh and Zeitlin. I think that you can see some discussion of that online. That initiative of GiveDirectly may shed more light on this question. In terms of what programs need to exist alongside cash transfer programs, I think we'd basically just be thinking about programs that are addressing market failures or addressing other issues. So, for example, I would think that infrastructure type programs would certainly be required alongside cash, and then on stuff that we actually recommend, health programs that have some degree of externalities where not all of the benefit is captured by the individual who, you know, would potentially be purchasing a bed net or malaria prevention medication. That's another type of cause where you'd expect that just giving cash transfers wouldn't necessarily address that issue. And then finally, you know, on whether progress has been made to benchmark high impact sectors, I'm not sure if I understand exactly what you're getting at there, but I think that's broadly what GiveWell is trying to do is trying to set a benchmark for what, you know, the most cost effective organizations are that donors can give to, so that people can compare against that. So we hope we're making progress in that area. But please do follow up if that's not what you're asking about.
Thanks. All right, we have a couple questions about evidence action, one submitted by Charles via info. In the past, you've recommended a number of interventions sponsored by evidence action. Do you think evidence action itself represents a good giving opportunity? And there is another question that was a little bit broader that was pre-submitted by Ellen, and it was about charities doing work to identify successful anti-poverty initiatives. So what do we think about groups like IPA, Innovations for Poverty Action, First Evidence Action, for example? And I should start by just clarifying too that for, you know, folks on the line, Evidence Action is the parent organization of Deworm the World Initiative, which has been one of our top charities for a very long time. Dispensers for Safe Water, which is a current standout charity, it is the parent organization of No Lean Season, the organization that we removed from our top charities list this year, but which we, you know, felt very positively about the experience as far as working with Evidence Action and their commitment to evidence goes. And then we've also made incubation grants to support Evidence Action, and most recently for a beta incubator portfolio. So we're working with Evidence Action through their beta program, which is work that they're doing to try to take studies of programs that look really promising and to design and test and scale those up. And with the idea that these could potentially become GiveWell top charities, so the grant that we made to support their work is one that we are hopeful will specifically target programs that GiveWell is interested in to take them to scale up. And so we are working quite a bit with Evidence Action today on a number of different programs that we've either recommended or supported via incubation grants. All right, and actually we are quite close to time here, and so my apologies, there were I think a handful of questions that we won't have time to answer on this call that were pre-submitted or sent in to info@givewell.org. We're going to do our best to follow up individually to folks that we have email addresses for who sent in a question that we didn't get to on this call. In addition, if we mention anything on this call that raised additional questions for you or that you'd like to follow up on, please do feel free to send us a note to info@givewell.org, and we will do our best to answer you via that platform. In addition, as a reminder, if you want anything removed from this recording, please email info@givewell.org in the next 24 hours. We expect to post this transcript or recording to our website. Finally, we'll be sending a follow-up survey to people who RSVP'd for this call and would very much appreciate you taking the time to fill it out. We really appreciate you joining. It's a lot of fun to see what questions people have and to have the chance to chat every year. So I'm very appreciative of you taking the time to listen to us talk about our latest work. And thank you also to my colleagues, Josh and Natalie, for their time and answering questions today. So thank you very much, everyone. I'm going to end the call now. And again, please just follow up via info@givewell.org if you have any further questions. Thank you.